Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Happy Monday. Today, the impact of and victims of medical racism. We talk to health equity experts about the role of race in healthcare access, as well as a patient whose childhood experience forever changed her relationship to medical care. Later in the program, we talk to the cast and creator of a musical love letter to historic La Villa. But first, combating the problem of bias in healthcare. To discuss that, I'm joined by Dr. Fern Webb, Associate Professor and Co-Director of the Center for Health Equity and Engagement Research at the University of Florida College of Medicine, Jacksonville. Hello, Dr. Webb.
Good morning.
Henny Stewart, former host of the talk show The Chat, which aired on the local ABC and NBC affiliates, First Coast News.
Ow, hey.
Welcome, Henny.
Good morning.
And in just a moment, we're going to be joined by Dr. Alex Porter. She's a philanthropist and founder of Elevate Med. I'm going to start with you, Dr. Webb. If you can talk to us about the problem of bias in medicine, where does that manifest itself?
Well, first of all, good morning, and thanks for having me on the show to talk about this very important topic. So bias manifests in so many different ways. And in medicine, oftentimes it's how we learn, how we react with others. And it's so subconscious that we don't even realize we're having some of these biases. And we just manifest it where one group might be treated quite differently than another group. It's inherent in our medical practices from the founding of this country. And so when it's so rooted in, it's hard to separate it out and even recognize it. So it has to be addressed head on to be able to say, yes, this is an issue, and let's figure out how to change it or improve it.
Is it the kind of thing that you see in a patient's experience? Is it the kind of thing that you see in health outcomes? Primarily, you know, how do you shape or define that problem?
It's seen in patients' experiences and seen in our health systems. It's so rooted in everything we do, where we live, where we breathe, how we talk, how we learn, how we interact with the institutions around us. So that's why it's so hard to separate it out. And it does manifest in our health outcomes. Minorities or African Americans, individuals or populations of color, because we try and stay away from minorities. We're all individuals and persons now. There's no such thing as a minority anymore. But it manifests in our outcomes. We're significantly more likely, African Americans, individuals of color, Black and brown communities, are more likely to have all host of health outcomes worse when compared to other populations. So yes, it manifests in the health systems. It manifests in our health outcomes. It manifests all around us. So it can be daunting.
Dr. Alex Porter, I believe we've got you now on the line. You're a neuro-oncologist at Mayo Clinic, Arizona, and I believe you're one of just three Black women practicing neuro-oncology in the United States. Is that correct?
Well, I'm delighted to say there's been more since that number was last published. And so I think we're up to five now. But thank you.
So medical racism is something that you personally experienced at the outset of your career when you wanted to become a doctor. Can you share that story?
Yeah, you know, I think that unfortunately, when you see images in the media, whether it's on TV or in print, oftentimes the Black woman wasn't necessarily the doctor in the scene. And so it took a lot of perseverance. And I have to say, I had to be a little stubborn at times. But the moment that stands out for me was when I returned to my medical school after being energized, having done a rotation at Mayo Clinic in neurology. And I shared, I found it. I found the specialty for me. I told the person who had been assigned to be my mentor as I matriculated through medical school. And I said, I want to be a neurologist. And he said, well, Alex, that's great, but you really don't look like a neurologist. And so I did what many of us do in those awkward moments, is I tried to make a joke. And I said, well, let me grab my bow tie and I'll make us all feel more comfortable about this decision. But the truth is, less than 1% of neurologists are Black women. And while I didn't necessarily appreciate his comments at the time, all it did was further fuel me to ensure I became the very best neurologist and trained at the very best centers in the country to be able to do so.
For people who maybe haven't given this a great deal of thought, how important is it for people of color to be in specialty medicine like neuro-oncology? Why does it matter, Dr. Porter, that patients be able to have a diverse possibilities to choose from when they're choosing a doctor or to be able to find somebody that looks like them to give them medical care?
Yeah, when we enter into the healthcare system, we are oftentimes at our most vulnerable. And already in a time when we are at that stage, we often look for clues to see, do I belong here? Am I safe here? Can I trust here? And there are so many complicated factors that go into why health disparities continue to be perpetuated over time. But one of the things that can be influenced very, very quickly to help with that feeling of belonging and trust is having a workforce that's representative of the folks that are being cared for. Because whether it's consciously or subconsciously, when I'm walking through the lobby of our hospital, there's a little smile when I see another patient who's Black or African American. When I walk into the exam room, sometimes I can feel a little sense of relief. And it's because people feel like, oh, she hears me, she sees me, she understands me. And so we know when there's that sense of belonging and trust, there's a much higher likelihood that there's going to be partnership and adherence when it comes to the treatment plan. And when that happens, that leads to improved outcomes. And that's really what we want. We want to ensure that people are living their most healthy lives and they're experiencing the outcomes that we know can be generated from following the treatments that are recommended. But it all starts with a sense of belonging and trust.
So let's talk about that, Henny Stewart, because that really is the antithesis of what you experienced as a teenager mm-hmm. when you were living abroad and you were on a military base in Germany living with family. Tell us about your experience. What happened? How old were you?
Yeah, sure. I was somewhere between 16 and 17. And at that time, I was experiencing headaches. So I had gone to this medical clinic on base. And I was sitting in the room waiting for the doctor to come in. But prior to the doctor come in, as we know, the CNA comes in and get your vitals and all that. So she did her thing, went outside the room, closed the door. But I can hear her and the doctor. And she told the doctor what my vitals were. And he said, oh, she's just a morbid, she's a Black morbid obese woman. And I heard that clear as day. And I'm thinking, was he talking about me? Like, he actually said that. And then when he did proceed to come into the room, gave him, you know, told him what was going on with me, the headaches, how often and all that. And he said, yeah, you just need to lose weight. So that he completely dismissed me as if I'm there just to be off school. It was nothing. But his words stuck with me. And hearing him through that door say what he said about me, how he labeled me without even laying eyes on me, it stuck with me even to this day. And it goes back to what Dr. Maya Angelou always says, is that people will often forget what you say, but they will never forget how you made them feel. And since I was 17 years old and to my fabulous age right now, I have never forgotten that, never forgotten those comments. And I made sure right now to make sure that my entire medical team, every professional that touches my body is people of color because they look like me and they get it. And I'm glad that I did that. It took some time to get that team together, but I'm glad that I did. And I did that because of the trauma that I experienced from the words that doctor said about me.
Did you at the time talk to anybody about what had happened or how that made you feel?
I did not. I completely held it in because I thought that was just normal. Of course, he wasn't the first and he won't be the last to label me and to call me a name. So I didn't tell not anyone. I never went to another professional to file a complaint. I just never went back there again.
And I seem to recall you saying that, you know, not only was he describing you that way, but was sort of saying, well, she can wait.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Of course, the clinic was full of patients that day. And he did say she can just wait. She's just a morbid obese Black woman. She can wait. And they made me sit there and wait like my care was not of importance to them. And I guess when he felt like it, he came on into the room.
Did it impact your view of healthcare thereafter?
Oh, I mean, big time. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I was very hesitant to the point where I had to be in a lot of pain to actually go to the doctor because I was very hesitant on what the type of care that I would receive. And, you know, people often will judge you by what you look like. And that's how a lot of times that they label you. So I was very hesitant in going to the doctor and I will say, in all fairness, it's still kind of that way to this day. I have to be in a lot of pain to go. And I know that it came from that experience. I can tell you what I had on that day. Like, that day is so vivid to me because it hurt. And it just stuck to me because I could not believe that a trained medical professional said those words out of his mouth about a patient and said it loud enough for me to hear it. And he said it in front of his assistant. Like, I'm not his first rodeo, I'm sure. So, I'm just very careful, and I have to be in a lot of pain to actually go and receive care.
Dr. Webb, how unusual is a story like Henny's?
Unfortunately, it's not unusual. And so as I sit here and I listen to her story, I'm sure many of us have experiences where that has happened. And it's unfortunate that something didn't happen. Like, how do we call or make aware of those situations? Mm-hmm. It would have been wonderful if you would have said something to him. But a 17-year-old, you know, you've in that position to feel so vulnerable.
Yeah. And I was in a lot of pain, so...
Yes. Yeah. And so it was wrong of the doctor. Hopefully that assistant could have said, well, you know, something's wrong with that, or no, that's not the way how we treat patients before or behind your back, or even the fact that it was okay and comfortable for him to say that. So that tells us it's on the system in itself. So it's unfortunately very comfortable as we talk more about these situations that we bring more to light, and we realize it's incorrect, it's just wrong. And if we start treating each other like if it was someone we love dearly, then maybe we'd be more sensitive and more empathetic. Mm.
You know, the question of people who experience medical racism, obviously it's not just people who, you know, are patients, but also people who work in the field. And the bias is a subject of a new book by Dr. Uchi Blackstock. She's a Harvard-trained emergency medicine physician, and she's the author of a book that's called Legacy, A Black Woman Reckons with Racism in Medicine. Mm. She spoke recently with our Dr. Joe Servin on his health show, What's Health Got to Do with It? Let's listen to a little bit of what she had to say about her own experience.
With a lot of Black patients, their concerns are often dismissed and ignored, and that leads to delayed diagnoses and misdiagnoses and even harm and death. I have this experience as a Black woman patient, but also on the other side as being in the system as well. I had to go to the ER 3 times with abdominal pain. I was questioned about how much pain I was in. I was questioned about my sexual activity multiple times. And turns out I ended up having a perforated appendix and I had significant complications. I missed a month of medical school. At the time, I was too scared to speak up. Even as a medical student, I was scared to speak up. But looking back on that experience, I always questioned, you know, as a young Black woman, would that have happened if I wasn't?
Dr. Alex Porter, I want to ask you about that. I mean, you've created a nonprofit that is focused on, as we said, creating an ethnically and racially diverse medical profession. But even within the field, as we hear from Dr. Blackstock, there are biases that you confront really all the time.
It's true. And when my husband and I started Elevate Med in 2019, we really wanted to create what we wished we'd had when we were matriculating through medical school and early in our careers. We wish we had money was the first thing. So scholarship support is a critical component of our program. We know that mentorship is critically important. You can't be what you can't see. Marian Wright Edelman said that, and I firmly believe it. And so providing these upcoming diverse future leaders in medicine with mentors who look like them doing what they do so they can see what their careers can look like years ahead. We know that physicians are leaders in whatever spaces they hold. So part of our program really focuses on leadership development, pulling out the strengths and developing a leadership plan for all of the students that are part of our program. And then financial wellness ends up being the fourth tenet. We know that medical students from diverse backgrounds are graduating with higher levels of indebtedness than their counterparts. And unfortunately, even within medicine, there are still pay discrepancies. with women and people of color often being paid less than their counterparts. And so understanding how to maximize the resources that are entrusted in them is critically important in raising the financial literacy of the entire complement. To seeing now that we're 5 years in, over $1.2 million awarded to diverse medical students across the country, the fifth tenet that has emerged as part of our program that we did not see, we did not foresee when we were developing the program, is the peer network that has developed. Often these students are feeling like unicorns in their own spaces, and the power that they're able to harness when they get together is just incredible. And so I'm often receiving text messages and emails about the students running into each other, either on the interview trail or at conferences. And having that network has become truly the priceless component of our program since we started.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking with people impacted by and also working to combat medical racism. If you have a story to share about your own experience or thoughts on the issue, you can join our conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media. We have a call from Keith in Riverside. Good morning, Keith. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I'm so glad you're discussing this topic. I experienced a traumatic incident of medical racism while laying on an exam table at the Naval Hospital, Jacksonville. The doctor who was getting ready to do a prostate biopsy accused me of circumventing his appointment system somehow and scheduling an appointment without his knowledge. He had also previously loudly cursed and called me a liar before he came into the room. And then he called me a liar twice as I lay on the exam table. This was 9 days after the Capitol insurrection. So I was a little bit apprehensive. I filed a complaint the following day, which was following workday, and they immediately circled the wagons around him. I had written a book about my experiences in the Navy, and when I told them about it, it obviously made him unhappy because I talked about racism in the military. I have spent the last 3.5 years trying to get the Navy to tell me what he said about me. I filed a complaint, an IG complaint, and nobody talked to me, interviewed me or my witness for either complaint. And then I filed a TRICARE grievance, which led to them finally giving me a letter backdated about 10 days saying that I had done nothing wrong. But they wouldn't tell me what he said, so I filed a FOIA request in April of 2021, and I still don't have that information released to me, even though it was the investigation was completed in November of 2022. Mm. So I would love to speak to one of those doctors and bring them up to date on what's going on in the military as far as discrimination against black males with ingrown hairs, PFB. And the Navy is trying to figure out what they're going to do about that. But I'd love to talk to them. I sent you an email this morning, Ann, so you have my contact information.
Keith, thank you so much for your calls and your comments. We have a call from Isaac in Jacksonville. Good morning, Isaac. Go ahead.
Hi. I'll give you my experience. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist and high-risk obstetrician at University of Florida. I'm originally from Ethiopia. I was introduced to medicine by a white physician, missionary doctor, actually from Berkeley, California. And I had no plan to go to medical school, but he asked me to follow him just for the day when he's making round. And at the end of the day, he said, I was just finishing my high school. And he said, how about going to medical school? And I said, no, I didn't think about going to medical school. I thought I enrolled for engineering and left. Anyway, long story short, this individual made a lifelong really impression on me. And I went back to medical school, changed from enrolling into going to engineering medical school, then from Ethiopia to New York, from there to Jacksonville, Florida. And since then, I have been an expert in the area of HIV/AIDS, and I've been all over the world. So the opposite influence I had from a white physician is entirely different than what you hear from the other side. So most of the people are really, if you have a bell-shaped curve, are in the middle. But there are people at the margins who might segregate or whoever do it. But the reason why this country and really the healthcare system continues to develop is most of the people who take care of all patients are in the middle. Yes, there are individuals at the margins who kind of stigmatize patients, who also stigmatize students, residents, or medical students. So we have to balance it out. You are hearing really just the other end. My end is I have been fortunate really to be introduced to medicine by this Dr. Nathan Barlow from California. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for that different perspective, Isaac. Dr. Webb.
Yes, and so to respond to that, he makes an excellent point. It takes a lot of individuals to make this work. And for all sides, regardless of race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, we have a lot of supporters. And for us to move this forward, we do need a lot of supporters. There have been a lot of individuals throughout my career who haven't looked like me, who still have championed and sponsored me. So we recognize that. But the saying of one bad apple kind of spoils the bunch, or for every negative comment you get, you need at least 7 affirmations. So it's traumatic. And to that first caller, the fact that he continues to fight is remarkable, but that's exhausting. And so how do we have some collective impact around these issues? We don't even talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that he is still championing this and he's battling a whole system. So we've got to recognize it goes sometimes beyond individuals. And we're dealing with fighting systems that have inherently had some biases in there. So, yes, there are a lot of individuals who are on both sides, on all sides, who are supporting a positive outcome. But for those who are like just it's time for them to either retire or just move on mm-hmm. because they are making some negative life-lasting impact.
We have a call from John in Riverside. Good morning, John. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Thank you. About 30 years ago, I developed a rash all over my body. And the first time my doctor saw it, he got this blanched look on his face. Okay, I still have the rash. It's non-cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, a cancer of the immune system. I'm a gay man. I'm HIV negative. I had several doctors kept saying, well, with AIDS, and I said, I don't have AIDS, I'm negative. And they would say it over, same doctor would say it over and over again. They couldn't get out of their mind that I could have a condition that wasn't related to my behavior, that wasn't related to me being gay. I'm fortunate this has never metastasized, and I fully expect to die of something else. But it does give me pause, especially when I have to deal with doctors from other cultures. I have a lot of respect for the other cultures. I have many friends, but I'm not sure how they will relate to me as a gay man. An example of this is I had experienced some transient nausea, and I went out of my way to say that I rarely have stomach problems. I'll never have an ulcer because all my problems go to my personality. And they still said, well, it was emotional. For example, if you saw a dead body, you'd throw up. And I'm thinking, if I saw a dead body, I'd call a cop, you idiot. But, you know, there are no dead bodies on my front porch. So, yeah, I do feel as a gay person, I have to factor in prejudice against gay people. And I don't think it's overt. I think it's I don't think they're aware of it.
Yeah.
You know, but it's still factor for me.
Thank you so much, John, for that perspective. I mean, there are obviously other biases that exist in medicine, and race is just one of them. We also have a comment from Junior on X. He says, the history of medical racism is widespread and rampant. This reminds me about the Tuskegee experiments. The topic is all the more reason for people to learn history. That, of course, is a reference to a study that brought in men who had syphilis and allowed it to progress without any treatment. They basically went blind or died or, you know, kind of lost their mind. So that was one terrible chapter. We heard about that a lot during COVID. I feel like that, you know, was that Tuskegee incident, those experiments raised as one of the reasons for skepticism in the Black community when it came to recommendations, health recommendations. Dr. Porter, there are obviously big examples of that. Do you think that the large incidents like that are more significant, or is it more the individual experiences that somebody like Henny Stewart experienced?
I really believe that it is individual. Of course, there are, and you're absolutely right, the conversation surrounding the Tuskegee experiment emerged around COVID after the vaccine came about. and the concern of what's in the vaccine, how is it made, how is it going to impact me, all of that. And there were narratives that were coming from the margins that really were unhealthy in terms of raising awareness to a public health crisis. And so, but really where we can make inroads is having personal discussions. And one of the narratives that we're trying to really dispel is that, as an example, the narrative that African Americans aren't interested in clinical trials because of the reference to the Tuskegee experiment. And so in looking at ways to combat health disparities, one of the ideas that we're starting to try to develop through a research protocol is to look at having pop-ups on the computer screen for physicians, providers, when there's a patient who's eligible for a clinical trial who happens to be of a diverse background, popping up some real data to say, did you know that when African-American patients are presented with a clinical trial, they are more than likely to enroll as long as you explain X, Y, and Z, to help dispel that myth that many physicians, providers might have in their mind that African-Americans don't want to enroll in clinical trials. Because of biases like that, we end up getting underrepresentation of certain populations in our clinical research, but it all starts with that first discussion, patient to physician. And so that's why I think the individual discussions end up having such a significant impact and ultimately will help us change the narrative about how African Americans, Black people feel about participating in clinical research. When it comes to cancer care, we know that when you are enrolled in a clinical trial, you get better care overall, which often leads to improved outcomes. And that's just because there are more touch points, there's more checking up, all of that. And so we really do know that this is the way that we move science forward, but we need to have representation from the entire community.
You know, the impact of racism in medicine, you know, really revealed itself with what I thought was a shocking news item this year, and that was that Black people were systematically denied placement on the kidney transplant waiting list. And that was based on an old faulty algorithm that basically said, you know, a certain element in the blood was, you know, more prevalent in Black patients than white patients. But Dr. Webb, this is a algorithm that's used in all kinds of medicine, not just kidney transplant waiting list folks who ended up, I think, after they corrected this problem, they moved 2 years up on the transplant list. But this medical algorithm is used in all kinds of things.
And that's an excellent point. And also to revisit what Dr. Porter said is so key when we get that information about clinical trials. But a key element of that is trust. And so we find that when individuals trust that provider, they trust that community health worker or that person sharing the information, they are likely to say yes to clinical trials. To the point about the algorithms, unfortunately, there's so many algorithms that are not based on individuals of color or individuals of different, again, race, ethnicity, are the different factors that make us up. So it takes revisiting these algorithms and trying to look at them in some unbiased, per se, eyes and being accurate. So that's one thing why we often are getting a bit nervous about AI, because we're coming up with algorithms that fail to account for the many factors that make us unique. And some factors should be eliminated, like the gentleman who called it about his sexual orientation was factored in. That should not have been factored in. It had nothing to do with that condition. Absolutely. And so as we come up with these algorithms, what factors do we, as an epidemiologist, what factors do we put in there that make it equitable and make it can lead to better outcomes? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we will come up with algorithms that exclude. We have to be transparent and honest that this system was not created for individuals of color. Mm-hmm. So the system itself is biased. Yeah. And when we're honest about trying to change the system, then we can come up with some better, more accurate algorithms.
You know, as I sit here and listen to the conversation and to the wonderful people that has wrote in, that has called in, and I'm processing it, the one thing that they all have in common is people. We've all been mistreated by people in some form or fashion by the lifestyle that we live, whether it is health-wise, sexual orientation choices. But the bottom line is we're still human. We're still people. But it's people that is making the poor choices that is causing, and I can, of course, speak for myself, that's causing the trauma that I have experienced was because that doctor made a poor choice to say those words for me to hear. It's people, the gentleman that called in about his sexual orientation, that should have never been a factor, as you said, but it's people that's making the poor decisions, the bad decisions. So I wonder if we will ever come out of this, if this will ever change, because people are people. People will change if and when they want to change. The world we live in now, yeah, that's not going to happen. However, it's people. And I just hope and I pray that one day that we don't have to have these conversations, because I think it's purely disgusting that we even have to be talking about this because we've experienced it from other people.
And you said something so key. And hopefully we're teaching our generations and the next generations to have that empathy mm-hmm. and to not be afraid to ask those questions in situations where we say, this doesn't feel right or this mm-hmm. doesn't seem just. Even if it doesn't exactly affect my circle, the fact that it's unjust to someone else.
Absolutely.
Then let's have these difficult conversations. We oftentimes don't want to talk about it because it's difficult. And then it's like, okay, now that we know we've uncovered this terrible thing, what next?
Yes,
what do we do about
next?
It?
Absolutely. Yeah. And we know there's power in numbers. And I think the right thing to do as a starting point is to talk about it, to continue to talk about it, not let it be something that has this little 3 minutes of fame and then it goes away. No, we think need to continue to sit and talk to people so that they will understand that your thought process may not be the healthiest, and to think about what you are saying and doing to people and the effect that it has on others. So I hope we can continue this conversation, even in small spaces, even in large groups, whatever it may be. Let's continue to talk about it because the struggle is real out here.
Henny Stewart, great to have you on. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective.
Thank you.
Dr. Fern Webb, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Dr. Alex Porter, thank you. Really appreciate you phoning in today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Up next, a new original musical is a love letter to historic La Villa.
All my life I've been a traveling man, staying alone and doing the best I can. I ship my trunk down to Tennessee. I ship my trunk down to Tennessee. Hard to tell about a man like me. I met a gal, I couldn't get her off my mind. I met a gal, I couldn't get her off my mind. She passed me up, said she didn't like my kind.
Welcome back. The historic La Villa neighborhood is sometimes called the Harlem of the South, but a new musical makes clear that Jacksonville laid the essential groundwork for New York's Harlem Renaissance. To discuss it, I'm joined now by Maxie Coleman, Creative Director at Jacksonville Arts and Music School. Welcome, Maxie.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you. Jason Peoples, the school's Executive Director. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. And Charity Hunt, a student performer who plays Harlem, the title of the play and musical, and also one of the Jam's originals. Welcome so much. Glad for having you, Charity.
Hi.
Hi. So, Maxie, what inspired you to take on this project in the first place, and how much research was involved?
Well, there was a lot of research. I think the inspiration came from our theme for the year. Every year we do a theme, and this year theme was around the historic La Villa and just the things that happened on Ashley Street. And so I am always just, I love period pieces. And I had started doing research probably about 10 years ago. A friend of mine was telling me about all the things that happened here. And so as I started researching and found out like all of the artists that came through here that were pivotal to the Harlem Renaissance, I got excited. And so it was a lot of research. A lot of historians weighed in and was like, oh, you got to make sure you say this and you got to tell this. So it's a lot. So it was really hard to try to, you know, bring it all into like tell one story. But we did our best to do it justice. And I think people are going to like it. I think
remind us, for people who may not know, there are so many names associated with La Villa who came through and performed in its heyday. But remind us of some of who those people are.
So I'll say that I was surprised. Zora Neale Hurston. You have Pat Chappelle. You have Eve Ma Rainey. And then, of course, we know James Weldon Johnson and John Roseman Johnson, who did a lot of work up in New York. Even Eartha Wight and the stuff that she did up in New York. So, and then more further down the ladder, you have people like Blind Blake, Leola Wilson, even the Ray Charles came through here. So
I think too, didn't Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, yes. Is really kind of just a destination for so many great performers. And so this play, this musical, it's original music, it's some new music. Tell us a little bit about the plot, and then I want to ask Charity about what role she plays.
Okay, so we wanted it to relate to a younger generation who may not be like big on the whole history thing. So what we did was we took a modern day situation of people that are in Jacksonville now that love the arts that are not familiar with what happened back then. And so Charity plays that character, Harlem, who is current. She's 2024 and she's a musician. And so she wants to get out of Jacksonville and go to New York because that's where everything is happening at. And so her great grandmother, who was here during that time, is the one that actually journaled stuff that's happening, that happened in La Villa during that time. So the journey is really her journey through that time period. So we bounce around from 1905 all the way up to 1920. And she just kind of walks this journey in real time. And see everything that happened during that time period. So
Charity, before you started this project, how much of this history were you familiar with?
Honestly, I knew like the bottom line of it, but I never like took the time to actually like think about, hey, these people are from here and these people are from there. So I really just knew like the baseline of it all.
And so your character is named Harlem. Is that supposed to be a direct reference to Harlem, New York, Harlem Renaissance?
Yes, ma'am, it is.
Yeah, and so what does your character discover?
Okay, basically Harlem starts off as this, not necessarily know-it-all, but she thinks she knows it all. And then throughout the show and throughout the story that is being told, she takes the time and she really learns from her grandma, Grandma Irene, and she just kind of changes as a whole, which is pretty freaking cool.
And so you also are singing. Are there some songs that are older songs that you perform, or are those being performed by other people?
Yes, some of the songs are being performed from other people, and I have a song towards the end.
Okay. And I want to ask you, Jason, I mean, this is a project that your school is taking on. Is it typical that Jacksonville Arts and Music tries to mix a little bit of like history with its curriculum, its musical curriculum?
Absolutely. As a creative youth development program here in Jacksonville, you know, our mission is to empower the creative leaders of tomorrow. And the genesis of that is the necessary need to develop leaders from the bottom up as the top continues to do what it does, and create avenues for students who want to stay here in Jacksonville, you know, go off to college, but return. But part of that is them understanding, our students understanding how significant Jacksonville is. Still is and was to the rise of so many great artists that they know today, that they're learning about today. So it's extremely important that we continue to show those historical facts as we continue to teach them about their history.
And people may not know that, you know, La Villa is, among other things, historically, the birthplace of the blues. I mean, that is the place where the first, you know, advertised blues performance happened. Yeah. Did you learn about this area and the history of it even yourself, like beyond what you already knew when this project began?
100%. 100%. So I was actually born in Palatka, Florida, a little town. They like to fancy themselves a city, but a little town about 45 minutes away from here. But I moved here when I was 8. So there was a lot of things that I didn't know. And I was just sharing with Charity jokingly that when I left the country, I was in the United States Army. So I left the country and traveled the world. And the last place I thought I was coming back was Jacksonville. The last place. 17 years later, three girls later, I'm still here. But it was because I saw something when I came back to visit that I hadn't seen before. And I felt something that I hadn't felt before. And I saw that the city was progressing. But not understanding that there's a lot that you didn't know, you know, through this process that you needed to learn in order to understand just how far Jacksonville has come and where it's going. So Maxie and the team, they've done a brilliant job of just educating me, along with Ms. Erin Kendrick and so many others that have educated me on this process as well.
Maxie Coleman, there is a lot of history in La Villa that's been lost in years recently because of demolition and, you know, historic buildings that have been removed. And what's left is, you know, in various states of repair or you know, renovation. Do you think that a project like this can animate a little bit more enthusiasm for or appreciation of La Villa and kind of maintaining what is left and building on that history?
Absolutely. And that's one of the goals that we have for this project, is not to let it be a one-time thing, but to continue every year to redo it, allow it to grow, and just educate those that are coming up to know that, hey, we have a rich history here. And we try to capture some of that so they can actually see it, because they have a downtown tour. But as you're walking, they would say, oh, this used to be this, and on this vacant lot used to be that. And so we really try to capture as much of that as we can to allow them to live in the space and see what it was like during its heyday.
And you and your performance try to recreate the Globe, right?
Yes.
Theater, which was the destination,
yes,
on Ashley Street for a long time. How, yes, did you come up with a vision for what that looked like?
So we got pictures as much as we could. And then a lot of that just based on the music, talking to historians like Mr. Ennis and people like that, Adonica. And with our design team, I think we did a pretty good job.
Yeah. Charity, what do you hope people take away from your performance or this musical overall when they see it?
I really hope that people leave here wanting to learn more. Me personally, being in the show, I have learned a lot and I want to dive deeper into that. So what I hope that people leave with is to want to learn more, to want to explore, and to want to actually do something to help keep the history alive.
And do you find yourself talking to your friends, you know, evangelizing and talking now about La Villa and more about what it meant in the history of Jacksonville?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Some of my friends have asked, hey, what's this show? And I'm like, oh, well, da 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 da. And they're just like, oh, that's really sweet. I'll look into that. And it's just this really cool thing that we talk about now.
So this performance takes place May 15th and 16th. It's actually here at the WJCT Soundstage. Maxie, how can people get tickets?
They can go to dearharlem.org, or they can go to jamslife.org, or they could go look it up on Eventbrite, Dear Harlem, A Letter from La Villa.
So there's also a couple of tiers of tickets.
Yes, we have three tiers. Regular seating, general seating is $25. And we have also preferred seating, which is like the first three rows, and that's $35. And then we have VIP seating, which with VIP, you could actually sit at a table inside the Globe Theater and have dinner inside the Globe Theater and be like hands-on with the performance.
Oh, so. Excellent. What a neat idea. Well, Maxie Coleman, Jason Peoples, Charity Hunt, thank you all so much for being here and talking about the project.
Thank you for having us.
Stick around. Up next, old buildings become a canvas highlighting local culture.
The Innocence Project of Florida presents Stand Up for Innocence, a night at the Comedy Zone featuring Michael Palasak and others to assist people who've been imprisoned unjustly. More info at floridainnocence.org/standupjacks.
Who took the bomb? On the next Fresh Air, feminist punk icon Kathleen Hanna. With her band Bikini Kill, she helped form the so-called Riot Girl movement, challenging the sexist punk scene in the 1990s. She'll talk about helping girls at her shows deal with sexual violence while dealing with it in her own life. Her new memoir is called Rebel Girl. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
This upcoming WNBA season may be the most highly anticipated season in league history, and all the attention is on one player.
Recovered by Gabby Marshall. Here comes Clark. How will she go for history?
Caitlin Clark helped elevate the game of basketball to new heights at the college level. What impact will she have in the pros? That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11, here on WJCT News 89.9.
20 minutes of reading a day paves the way to success, and we can make reading a game. Read game instructions together or go on letter scavenger hunts throughout the day. Remember, it all adds up to 20 minutes.
For more information, readjax.org.
Maryland's Senate primary race this Tuesday is attracting national attention for the low blows and the high dollars. Democratic Representative David Trone is spending tens of millions of dollars from his own bank account.
That ability to be on your own means my vote doesn't belong to anybody.
Deep pockets and the rise of the self-funded candidate. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. More than 50 artists will descend on Springfield this weekend to transform some of its buildings into colorful tapestries. I'm joined now by Elena Olander, artist and curator of the Jack's Wall Project Mural Jam. Hey, Elena.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. So what is the Jack's Wall Project Mural Jam? What is it?
Well, we've teamed up together with Phoenix Arts and Innovation District to bring these talented artists hailing from both our local neighborhood and our vibrant state of Florida to create some fun art.
So this is happening in Springfield writ large, but in the Phoenix Arts District,
correct,
which I think of as being pretty well kind of muraled already. There's, you know, a lot of great art on a lot of cool buildings. Mm-hmm. So are these going to be covering over the existing art, or are they going to be in new places?
I think it'll be a combination of both. The nature of exterior works or public works is that they are impermanent and often change. So it's going to be a fun process watching it change and evolve over time.
So this is like a live event where people can come and explain how they're going to be either interacting with or just observing the artists at work.
Sure, yes. While this event is primarily a playground for our artists, we extend a warm invite to the public to join us as spectators. So from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. each day, you can witness kind of the magic of these masterpieces come to life right before your eyes.
This is this Saturday and Sunday?
Correct.
And so is there something, a shared experience that these artists have by being there at the same time and all creating at the same time?
Yeah, I think there's a great sense of community. And myself, as an artist and muralist, I've traveled, you know, to other cities doing this with those communities. And so we have a conversation and we network and we see each other at festivals and things across the state. So
are you going to be creating at this weekend's event?
I'm going to try, but I'll probably end up mostly doing it after the festival. Yeah.
Okay. Do you go in with like a vision of what you are going to make, or does the inspiration take you and you just, you know, wing it?
Personally, I like to have a little bit of a plan, mm-hmm. But it's open for the artist to express this right. time. There's no specific theme.
So is there a guide anywhere that people can find out who the artists are that are participating, where they're from, or look at any of their earlier work?
Well, at the moment, we're going to try to highlight on our Instagram, Jack's Wall Project and Phoenix Jacks, as well as the phoenixjacks.com website. You can find more info.
So over the last several years, certainly the last decade, there have been a lot of public art murals particularly added around Jacksonville. How do you feel like that has transformed, or has it, I mean, changed the experience of being downtown, which really used to be a very beige kind of concrete space.
Yeah, I think it's really wonderful, especially coming through COVID and having those outdoor galleries has been life-changing for so many people. It's exciting to see new art pop up around the city and get to know artists that they love and connect with them.
But as you say, it can be fleeting. I mean, I think of the Sean Thurston frog mural that was lost in the renovation of a bar recently. Some of those images really become iconic, and I think there's a sense of loss, even though you say it's impermanent.
Yeah, it is interesting to navigate, especially as a muralist myself. I see and meet graffiti writers and muralists alike, as well as wheat paste artists. And there's kind of a divide, really. Like, some people really hope to, you know, create something that's lasting forever. But of course, because of its exposure to the elements, it's bound to evolve over time and degrade. But I think that's beautiful, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, transformative.
Kind of part of the artwork itself.
Yes.
Is that change?
I think so, personally. Yeah.
That's interesting. So when people come to attend, I know that there's going to be some food for a few hours there, but what should they bring and how should they plan to attend this event? How long will they stay? Will they kind of camp out there?
Sure. I think it's kind of like a walking tour, really. So you can walk about the footprint and see the artists as they install their works. If you want to bring a chair and a cooler with you, that's always a great idea to talk with the artists and watch and spectate.
And is the expectation that the artists will be available to talk, or are they going to be sort of wrapped up in the work that they're doing?
I think majority of the artists will be wrapped up in their work, but it is a leisurely thing. They're free to come and go at their leisure and produce their works how they see fit.
Yeah. And most of these murals will take more than a day to complete, or?
I think each artist, they get a amount of space approximately 15 to 20 feet square. So they can fill that all the way, or they can fill it just a portion of it. It's totally up to them.
This is a free event?
It is a free event.
All right. And it starts at?
At 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. each day.
Okay. Terrific. Well, it is so nice to have you, Elena. Thank you for being back on the program, and good luck painting this weekend.
Thank you so much.
And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send either to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock tonight or find our entire archive at wjct.org or on your favorite podcast platform. The executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our show is produced by Stacey Bennett and directed by Brady Corum. Join us tomorrow when we talk to a local couple teaming up to help others open independent bookstores. Join us then at 9 tomorrow. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.